This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
For those of you who aren't familiar with the Office of Clients' Rights Advocacy, I'll do a quick little spiel. So the Office of Clients' Rights Advocacy serves consumers of regional centers. So for each regional center, there's 21 regional centers throughout the state of California. For each regional center, there is a clients' rights advocate assigned for that regional center and an assistant clients' rights advocate. It's a little confusing because a lot of times we're housed in the regional centers, but we're completely separate from the regional center. And we provide advocacy, we do a really broad spectrum of advocacy and representation. It could be special education, trying to obtain additional regional center services. It could be if there's issues with rights in a facility. Let's say, maybe a group home has a ridiculous bedtime of 7 o'clock at night, we might get a call to investigate and talk about the reasonableness of adults going to bed at 7 o'clock at night in their own homes. And then we also provide a lot of training regarding clients' rights. And another big portion of what we do is assist people who have been denied eligibility for regional center services, and we kind of give a second look. So just be aware if you come across any folks who receive services from the regional center, where our office is here to provide advocacy and assistance. Our other little thing that we've been flooded with lately are Social Security cases. So just so you know that's what we're here for. So today I'm gonna kind of talk broadly about why we've come to have so many laws for people with protecting and for people with developmental disabilities. So that's going to be my part of the presentation, and then we're each going to present our slides, and then have hopefully a lot of discussion and a lot of questions, because we really want to hear from you, your experiences, your questions, just practical things and anything that we can do to help and That's why we're here today. So the Lanerman Act is the set of laws that are in place for people who receive regional center services. So it's laws regarding services that they're entitled to, rights that they're entitled to, and just basically how the regional center systems operate. And so the first part that I wanted to start off with is this section. It's in the Lanerman Act code, and when I first started working here, I just kind of skimmed over it. I didn't really realize the importance of why they actually had to restate in the Welfare and Institutions Code that people with developmental disabilities have the same legal rights and responsibilities guaranteed to other individuals by the United States Constitution, and so both state and federal laws apply and protections apply to people with developmental disabilities. So basically, I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of why this had to be actually, restated and why it was so important. And the history of how people with disabilities, especially people with developmental disabilities, have been treated in this country has been pretty atrocious throughout throughout time, and a large part has to do with the institutionalization that became so prevalent. You know, that's where people with developmental disabilities were placed, and also people with other disabilities were placed in institutions, and that was kind of the status quo for too long. And also the eugenics movement, where people with disabilities and also other people, you know, a lot of other minorities throughout time, they were forced to be sterilized in an effort to make sure society was functioning better if they can control who was reproducing or not. So those are kind of some of the history of why it's so important to remember that people with disabilities have the same protections that we do. Because a lot of times, there can be, because of the history, there can kind of be this attitude of we can make choices better for somebody else, that someone doesn't know better, so we can make the choice for them. And I just kind of want to go back a little bit in talking about institutionalization is just really the stripping of rights, because we hear that term thrown around, but when you, and we're going to get a little bit more in depth, but when you really think about what that means to be in an institution and to not be able to access what you want to access when you want to access it, to not be able to access your family when you want to not be able to go to the store, go to school. There's a lot more than just being able to say, oh, someone's in an institution, so this is why this slide is here. This is what we're starting off with. So some of the really big principles in the Constitution are these principles, are the principle of liberty. So when we start off with liberty, we're thinking of, you know, liberty is the ability to choose. I mean, in its essence, is to have the right to choose, to have the right to choose where you live, to have the right to be part of a conversation about how you're cared for or what supports you need. Liberty is a really important piece. It's the right to petition, to access legal rights, to change services or to change your placement. So that's why liberty is such an important piece. And again, back to the right to live in the community a lot of times. And then privacy, I think this is also another big piece, because when people are living, especially when people are receiving services from government agencies or other agencies, there can be a tendency to maybe share information with either between agencies or with a family member, with the intent to be helpful, but you really have to think about privacy. And sometimes we get calls from people in the community, and they may say, there could be, just trying to think of a good example of privacy, you know, like a parent may call me and may ask me about an adult consumer, you know, and how we're providing assistance to that person, or may want to give me some information. And unless that person has given me permission, unless the client has given me permission to speak with that parent, I really have to stop. I mean, I really need to remember that, because sometimes we get caught up because we want to be helpful, and we get these calls coming in, or you're meeting with people and family members, and it's just really just kind of, I always have to stop and think, is it okay to be sharing this information? Would I want my mom to know this information about me? Would this adult consumer want their parent to know this information about them? And it's just kind of, a lot of it's just checking in and just thinking it through a little bit, and not automatically going for the, you know, we're trying to care for people and just responding. And that's just one key piece for privacy. And, you know, and then privacy to the other, the other side of privacy is people's right to privacy regarding relationships and being able to be intimate, those types of privacy issues that come up. And again, this is all tied with personal autonomy, with choice. So a lot of the principles have to do with choice and people having the right to make choices and self-determination, people being able to speak up for themselves and to be a part of a conversation. I can sometimes catch myself, and I really try to be conscious of it, when I'm meeting with a consumer who I'm not sure how much they may understand of what I'm discussing, and, you know, their family members there, and I have to, you know, really be conscious that I'm not only focusing and speaking with the family member, because they're the ones who are going to give me the most feedback, but actually, you know, being aware that this is the consumers, this is what we're here for, to empower people and to give them the option to be a part of a conversation. And people sometimes don't want to be. No, I don't want to hear about it. You can talk to my mom about it, or you can talk to my support person. But other times people, you know, do want to hear about it and do want to be a part of it. So just being conscious of that interplay.
So I'm just going to touch on some of the rights that are listed out in the Lanterman Act. And as Jalalia said, these are written out specifically in the law because these rights have historically been stripped of people who have disabilities and people who are developmentally disabled. And so first listed here is dignity and humane care in natural community settings. And this is really important. As Jalalia spoke about the history of institutionalization, that still occurs today. But where we've come from that is a place where people have the right to live in the community and receive the care that they need in a community setting so that they're in an environment that's integrated. They're around people. They're spending time out in the community and have access to services and supports to help them live healthy, happy, fulfilled lives. So in kind of thinking about this and back where we were with institutionalization, you know, this is a lot of the time people with disabilities who had maybe medical issues or medical conditions were kept or made to live in institutions because, you know, it was thought that their medical needs were too severe for them to be able to live in a home as, you know, others do in the community. So now we have services and supports that help people, you know, instead of living at developmental centers, live in group homes and get the access to medical treatment and care that they need, but they can also be a part of our community. They can participate in day programs and school and education while getting the help that they need, but living in a less restrictive environment. So, you know, that's kind of what we're touching on with dignity and humane care and natural community settings. That's what that means. There's also the right to participation in publicly supported education. So as we all know, people with disabilities have the right to supports to allow them to, you know, participate in education. So we have special education laws, the IDEA, and other, you know, protections for people to be able to get educational services and what they need to get an education. So another right listed out in the Lanterman Act is the right to prompt medical care and treatment. And this is really important. I mean, in the past, people with disabilities, like I was saying, they were living in institutions where sometimes, you know, they didn't have access to any medical treatment. And often people, you know, even didn't get the medical treatment they needed to live and historically have even died in institutions because they didn't have access to medical care. So this is a really important part of our law, that people, you know, have access to medical care if they want it and need it, and they have the, you know, ability to get support to access that treatment. Also, we have religious freedom and practice. So people have the right to practice a religion or not practice a religion. You know, sometimes we get calls from people that live in group homes, maybe in the community, and there's one church or religious institution that the whole entire group home goes to. And someone maybe doesn't want to go to that one. They want to go to a different one, or they don't want to go at all. That's a right listed in the Lanterman Act, you know, under personal rights. So that's something to keep in mind. People have the choice, and they have the right to get support to participate in religious activities if that's what they want. The right to social interaction and recreation. You know, like I was saying, going back to the past and institutionalization and where we are now, people have the right to, just like everyone else, be in the community and spend time with peers and people, and you know, go out into the community and do things. So an example of that is a lot of the people with developmental disabilities that we assist, you know, maybe participate in work supported work programs, supported employment programs, group homes, where they're able to get the support they need to go into the community and spend time. That's one of their rights. And it's one of their rights to make choices about what they want to do when they're in the community. So rights continued. People have the right to be free from harm, including unnecessary physical restraint, isolation, excessive medication, and abuse and neglect. So these protections, again, are listed in the Lanterman Act because of the history of how people have been treated in our society. And so we're touching on this because, you know, often we think, well, look where we are now. We've come so far, you know. But these things still happen. These laws are still there, you know, and they're there to protect the rights of people who have been mistreated in the past. So we'll touch a bit more on what some of these unnecessary isolations and medications look like and have in the past and now. But that's definitely an important right to be written out. The right to make choices involving leisure, employment, and the pursuit of personal future. Again, you know, just having that list written into the law so that people, you know, can make choices about what they want to do in their lives. The right to exercise decision-making skills in any aspect of day-to-day living. So that covers a lot of different things. You know, that covers the right to make decisions about medical care. You know, maybe someone, Jalali and I were kind of talking about it earlier, you know, a person may have a medical condition where their doctor may suggest, you know, you probably shouldn't eat that type of food, or, you know, you need to do this for your health. Well, like we all do, we make choices about that, and it's our body and our lives to decide if we want to, you know, follow that suggestion. So we really have to think of that when we're providing support for people with developmental disabilities, that what we think is right isn't necessarily what the person wants and is their choice to make. So, you know, just because I'm diagnosed with diabetes per se, you know, something like that, and I have to do a specific type of medical treatment, I mean, I choose to do that, and we have to respect that an individual may not want to participate in medical care that's suggested to them. So that's the right to exercise decision-making skills. You know, so that's medical treatment. That also is in your day-to-day activities and living. Like I was saying, religious freedom, the right to choose if you want to go to a church or what have you, or choose not to. You know, an individual with a developmental disability, just like all of us, has that choice to make. So we just want to highlight how those are specifically listed in the law, because even though that's part of the Constitution, these types of, you know, rights, they really had to be specifically listed in the Lanterman Act so that we can help people, you know, be integrated into our society and have the right to make choices in their lives. So
again, in talking about, you know, rights, it's people have rights, and they also have the right to refuse different types of treatment. And again, as we keep harping on, because of all the history of abuse and abusing these treatments being used excessively or in a really dangerous manner. So people have the right to refuse the electroconvulsive therapy. They have the right to refuse behavior modification techniques. And so these techniques
We recently were doing a training, and a staff person was explaining how one of their behavioral techniques was to blow a whistle near the client's ears to get them to board a bus. And this is really an extreme behavior modification technique that shouldn't be happening unless the client was consenting to it. And in this case, he wasn't. So these are things that we have, also prodding people to get them to go places, and the right to refuse psychosurgery, the right to refuse modification or control of thoughts, feelings, actions, or behavior. People have the right to refuse. And sometimes people have the right to consent if that's what they want, but it's just important to know that somebody else can't consent for them. We got a call recently from a service provider who wanted to know whether the conservator could consent to somebody being restrained as part of their behavioral therapy. And absolutely not. Nobody else can consent to any of these treatments. So because the right belongs to the person, and a conservatorship wouldn't pass that right to their conservator. And we'll talk a little bit more, about the difference of rights with people who are conserved and not conserved, but that's just an example that came up. And confidentiality, again, we're going to discuss it more in depth. But just to remember, again, like I said, this is in the Welfare and Institutions Code, just about the importance of keeping records and information confidential. And it's from the time that you come in contact with the person who has a developmental disability, that information is confidential. And it's under this Welfare and Institutions Code 4518. Just the importance of the confidentiality. And because it's been historically so trampled, there's actual damages and fines that can be levied against someone who breaks the confidentiality of a person with a developmental disability.
So certainly my talk is not going to be that compassionate or that personal. I unfortunately have the boring part of the presentation, and I apologize in advance for that. I really want to come back and try to just kind of define some of the laws and regulations that affect the privacy of all individuals and then those that are specific to developmental disabilities. I won't reiterate the Lanier-Petrus Act, but I will try to give you other contexts in which developmental disability rights are woven into our law. All right, so we'll start with the ADA, because all individuals with any form of disability are protected under the federal, and there's a state compendium of the American with Disabilities Act. So a disability means a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, and there's a history, a record of such impairment, or it's being regarded as having such an impairment, whether or not that individual has one. And a major life activity, of course, involves caring for oneself, performing manual tasks, walking, speaking, hearing, breathing, learning, working. So the state law specifically defines developmental disabilities under our probate code. And that's a disability that originates before an individual attains an age of 18, continues or can be expected to continue indefinitely, and constitutes a substantial handicap for such individual. And the law specifically calls out specific diagnoses such as epilepsy, autism, cerebral palsy, mental retardation, and conditions requiring services similar to those with persons with mental retardation. And it excludes, though, the physical handicaps, those that would be covered under the American with Disabilities Act, but not considered a developmental disability under the law. All right, so the ADA protects prohibits discrimination on the basis of disability. And Title II of the ADA requires states and local governments to provide individuals with those qualified disabilities an opportunity to benefit from all programs and services, including health care. And the federal law specifically states that a disability does not diminish an individual's right to exercise control and choice over their own life. So the individuals have a right, all individuals have a right of to receive information in support in making decisions about their lives. They have a right to receive services and support provided in a manner respectful of individual dignity and personal preferences. And they have a right to receive appropriate treatment and services designed to maximize the individual's potential and receive this care in the least restrictive setting of the individual's personal liberty. So all of those themes that are actually reflected in the LPS Act are also specified in a broader context in our federal law. How this kind of weaves into individuals' privacy related to healthcare, I think, are in two most specific ways. One, the confidentiality of an individual's information, and two, the right to make healthcare decisions. So we're going to talk about those kind of two themes or concepts related to individuals with developmental disabilities. So first, more boring law stuff. So what's HIPAA? Anyone that works in a health system, it seems to be quite a bit a part of their life. And, you know, the joke of it is in 1996, the federal government passed a series of regulation really designed to really speak to health insurance portability, the idea of individuals being able to actually move their health insurance benefits and rights, or keep those rights from one employer to another. Has a lot to do with insurance, has a little tiny bit to do with privacy, but that little tiny bit of a much broader law has become what we call HIPAA. So under what I call the administrative simplification portion of the federal law, which if anyone has ever dealt with HIPAA, there's nothing simple about it. That section was enacted to protect the privacy of an individual's health information and to provide for both the physical and the electronic security of that protected information, and to specify the rights of patients and their right to control the use, access, and disclosure of that information. HIPAA doesn't talk about consent, so we'll talk about that in a little bit. This really talks about an individual's right to keep their information confidential. So what's protected under the federal regulations? Anything that's considered protective health information that's individually identifiable, which means it includes demographic information that's collected by a healthcare provider or a health insurance plan that relates to a person's past, present, or future medical condition. And that health information is created or received by a healthcare provider, and they're not education records. So actually student records related to their health are actually guided by completely different sets of laws. So these are the elements of somebody's information that's protected under the regulation. And you can see there are things that are purely demographic, like somebody's address or their telephone number, and then things that are actually more, you know, specific related to their medical information. All right, so that's the federal rubric, and then the state law also has protected. So California, which is kind of a state somewhat unique in the United States, in that we've had very forward-thinking privacy laws on our books since the early 70s. And so for many states, when HIPAA came around, that was kind of a whole new gamut of laws related to patient privacy that states really didn't have weaved into their own state law. So there was a much larger learning curve and process change that needed to occur. In our state, we've always had the Confidentiality of Medical Information Act, CMIA, that protects people's rights for health information. Now, the struggle for those that work in this is that to try to kind of balance, or not balance, but kind of bring together what HIPAA requires and what state law requires, and when they the two kind of conflict, which one do we follow and how do we follow it? But for the purposes of this discussion, California law has specific protections on medical information, and that's any individually identifiable information, which again I've defined here below. So that is regarding a patient's medical history, mental or physical condition, or treatment. That's protected so both under federal law and state law. So on top of those particular laws, there are laws woven into our state statutes that speak to individuals with developmental disabilities. All information and records obtained during intake, assessment, and treatment services to patients with developmental disabilities shall remain confidential. Probably not so necessary to have that delineated for developmental disabilities, given the very strong protections we have with medical information. But I think I learned, along with you, kind of the reasons for maybe those types of reiterations in our law specific to people with developmental disabilities, which is actually, you know, very helpful to me, because sometimes I find it rather bother and cumbersome of why we have so many laws that kind of say the same thing. But any event. And so, generally speaking, the disclosure of protected health information only occurs when the individual has authorized or agreed for that disclosure, or if there is a specific exception in the law, and we're going to talk about some of those exceptions in just a minute. And so those exceptions for both that are codified both in this federal regulation, in state law under the Confidentiality of Medical Information Act, and specific laws related to individuals with disability are relatively the same. They're not perfect. They don't do a crosswalk beautifully. And I'll kind of give you some examples in a bit. But generally, there are some pretty well accepted exceptions. So for instance, as healthcare providers, we may disclose without a patient's authorization patient information for the purposes of seeking treatment, so to talk to another provider for services. We may disclose information to health plans for the purposes of payment. We may disclose information to certain state or federal regulatory bodies. So, for instance, if we have independent duties to report certain diseases to various federal authorities and state authorities, we have the right to use information to provide it to a coroner upon a patient's death. We have the right to have information. We may disclose information without the patient's authorization to law enforcement under very narrow exceptions. But for instance, if they are investigating a certain crime. So there's lots of exceptions weaved into both the federal, state, and specific laws, and they're roughly the same. Now, you know, there's lots of questions that come up in our health institution, especially when we rolled out all the education related to HIPAA and confidentiality, that talk about, well, what are our limitations as far as just speaking to others? So if an individual has that autonomous right to maintain the confidences of their information, there's this, all of a sudden there was this initial panic of, well, what do we do about if mom is in the room and if the patient is an adult? Or what do we do if there's, you know, a friend that wants to come with them to an office visit? So the protection of PHI can be reasonably inferred based on the exercise of professional judgment that the individual doesn't object. So I kind of highlight this slide that basically says the federal regulations specifically say that PHI may be disclosed or shared with family members or other relatives or personal friends of an individual if that is directly relevant to the person's involvement in the care of the patient, and this speaks to all patients, not just developmentally disabled patients, or if it's related to the payment of the patient's health care, and that until and unless a patient objects, we may make reasonable inferences from the circumstances. But the patient always has an ability to stop us from further disclosing information to the family, friends, whatever it is. And once we know of that, we're duty bound not to share that information. And so it's always wise that patients may and physicians may wish to discuss the disclosure with the patient first and provide that patient that opportunity to object. And so as healthcare providers, if there are individuals that are often coming with the patient for their healthcare, that's something that obviously we would advise, especially if that if there is a large change of in the individuals, or if there's any concern about the individual that is coming with the patient. So we talked about those exceptions. The state law that's specific to developmental disabilities has a whole section that talks about the exceptions of from not disclosing information. So again, it's very similar to the federal regulations and our own and this Confidentiality of Medical Information Act. For instance, in communication between qualified professional purposes, we don't have to obtain the consent or authorization of the patient before sharing the patient's information. When the patient with developmental disabilities has the capacity to consent, then and they designate individuals for whom to whom the information may be released, we can rely on that and of course share that information. If the patient is a minor and has a guardian, or if the patient is under a conservatorship, then that conservator or that guardian basically stands in the shoes and may give authorization stands in the shoes of the patient and may give authorization accordingly. And then, of course, again, the same idea with regard to payment with regard for health insurance or application for government benefits. There's an exception under the laws as far as being able to disclose it. Also, for specific research purposes, disclosure is permissible so long as the research is part of is authorized by the IRB. Interestingly, and this would be for a whole other topic of which I am not qualified to speak, individuals with developmental disabilities may, like all other individuals, participate in research. The law has additional regulations to protect those individuals developmental disabilities in that participation. So there's more strict regulations that researchers must adhere to, including it requires an oath of confidentiality that researchers must sign related to the information about the individual with the development. Mental disabilities. All right, and then of course, if there's a guardian, of course, may have has the ability to obtain medical information and stand in the shoes of the patient. The issue that we're often faced with, which every parent is faced with, is when the child magically turns this age of 18. Not that they're responsible or know anything about what's best for them. Spoken as a true mother, all of a sudden, that guardian, that parent, no longer has the right to access the patient's medical information, and that's no different, of course, with people with developmental disabilities, and that's hard for any parent or guardian to actually accept, since they've been sitting in that medical office since the day they were born. But that's something that is, you know, that healthcare providers really have to be cognizant of, and we often forget because we just are used to the same circumstances. All right. So, yeah, an interesting clue is when that person reaches that magical age of 18, then even records pertaining to their treatment before the age of 18 becomes locked to a parent or guardian without that specific authorization. So, adults. Who is an adult? So we'll talk about capacity as far as who is considered an individual that has the capacity to make a decision. So first of all, that person has to either be 18 years of age or older, or they have to be a minor who has entered into a valid marriage so that they are legally married, or a minor who is on active duty with the armed services. That takes you out of that 18-year-old requirement. Then they can make full healthcare decisions for themselves, or a minor that's been adjudicated as emancipated under the law. So when he or she reaches 18, he's presumed to have the capacity to do all things that in any other society may do, regardless of disability. So once we determine that the person is of the right age or that there's an exception that applies. Capacity continues. Decision-making capacity, of course, includes the ability to understand the nature and the consequences of the decision, to make and communicate a decision, and understand the significant benefits, risks, and alternatives of that health care. And who determines capacity? You know, we have this argument at UC Davis all the time because it's really, you know, they always want that psych consult. And, you know, quite honestly, it's the body of literature states that physicians should be able to determine whether a patient has decision-making capacity and who can act as a decision-maker if the patient is unable to do so. This is for all patients. And psychiatric input may be helpful, but that isn't a required part of our processes. All right. Decision-making is a dynamic, task-specific, and challenging talent, and impairment is not situational, and some patients may be competent for one decision but not another, depending on the gravity of the circumstances and the consequences of that decision and the risk for potential harm. And patients, of course, may lack capacity on a temporary or on a permanent basis. It is the assumption, though, for all healthcare providers that a patient that's presenting him or herself for treatment has the capacity to make a healthcare decision, whether that patient is disabled or not disabled. So there has to be specific evidence to the physician to the contrary. In my slides here, I talk a little bit more about how the decision-making capacity occurs and the fact that certain types of cognitive tests should not be used for a substitution. So it has been well shown that some patients who lack decision-making capacity may have, you know, high scores on the mini mental exams, while others who perform poorly may be capable of making healthcare decisions. So it's really a very dynamic process to make that decision. Again, remember I said we keep on going back to the fact that folks with developmental disabilities have specific laws that say these. So we have general laws that speak to all patients that still apply to those with developmental disabilities. But under the probate code, a developmentally disabled adult shall be presumed competent, so reiteration of what I just said, to make his or her medical treatment decisions unless there is evidence to the contrary. And that court determinations of incapacity shall be based on evidence of a deficit in one or more of the person's mental functions rather than a diagnosis of a person's mental or physical disorder. And that's a very important distinction. And consent may be provided for developmentally disabled adults deemed incompetent to make their own healthcare decisions by an individual's agent or conservator or by court order. And we'll talk about that in just a second. All right, one more time. It's all over. You know, an adult with the capacity has a right to make his or her own decisions, and that includes, and this is the hard one, not only consenting to medical treatment, but refusing medical treatment, something that physicians really struggle with a lot. They don't like to make recommendations and the patients say no. Anyway, so patients with adequate decision-making capacity are allowed to make autonomous choices about their health care. Even this is even harder, again, for our healthcare providers, even those choices that may seem irrational to the healthcare provider. All right. So if for whatever reason a patient is determined to lack capacity, then who has the right to stand in their shoes? There are often, not as often as we would like, pieces of paper, as I call them, that help inform the decision maker. If somebody has what's called a post, and that's for really end-of-life decision-making, so I'm not going to focus on that today, or an advanced healthcare directive that actually identifies an agent for healthcare, an agent to make decisions for healthcare decisions, or if the patient orally designates an agent to make that healthcare decision to a healthcare provider. Let's say a patient is hospitalized. And if a patient is hospitalized and they don't have a advanced healthcare directive, they can orally designate an individual, a family member. And for the duration of that hospitalization, that individual has the ability to make decisions on behalf of the patient. If the patient decides that they want to basically surrender their rights to that individual, or they're unable, don't have the capacity to make those decisions. And then, of course, letters of conservatorship, which we are much more familiar with in the for developmentally disabled patients, and or any reasonable patient representative, and I will emphasize that next of kin rule doesn't apply. So under the probate code, if you die, there's a nice list of who gets to make decisions about what happens to you once you're dead. That same probate code, so that's the parent or an adult child, and it kind of goes down the whole, you know, family tree list. Those same delineations of next of kin does not apply for healthcare decisions. And it's really up to a healthcare provider, once they've exhausted all the paper that will also help inform them, to make decisions about who's best able to make the decision for the patient if the patient lacks capacity. So I'll touch on conservatorships just briefly. It's about legal authority to individuals who seek to aid an incapacitated adult. Conservatorships often provide broad authority for conservators over the conservatee. Limited conservatorships defines the conservator's degree of authority and duty to act on behalf of the individual. So we looked at the letters of conservatorship to see what the powers of the conservator are regarding healthcare decisions. If there's a lack of capacity, a conservatorship will always give the conservator the right to consent to treatment. The conservatee's consent does not need to be secured, but even in the circumstances where a patient's been conserved, the physician may wish to explain the decision to the conservatee and really listen for things that may give rise to a physician's question about whether or not this is the right decision for the patient. The purpose, of course, is to protect adults with developmental disabilities from harm or exploitation while allowing for the development of maximum self-reliance. So it's usually used among adults with developmental disabilities. It's often that the process is initiated months before a patient turns 18 in anticipation of a parent's recognition that their legal rights over their child will go away very soon. And then there is, under our judicial system, a process in which those conservatorships are supposed to be subject to a review 1 year and then every 2 years thereafter to ensure the conservator is still working in the best interest of the conserved party. And as has already been mentioned, there are certain things that conservatorships do not permit the conservator to make decisions of, and I've identified them here. So it would require a specific court intervention. It would actually require to actually seek any of the above. So it's important to note that there are true limitations when it comes to a conservator's ability. All right. So we have talked about this already, the idea that a limited conservatorship does, though, permit the conservator to stand in the shoes of the patient when it comes to the access to medical information and to assist the conservatee and to participate in decision-making regarding the treatment and to participate in those services.
So I just, since I'm the client's rights advocate, I just had one more slide to just talk about just the other side of conservatorship. I just wanted to briefly touch on it. Because we frequently get calls just basically from the client, the patient's side, who doesn't want to be conserved. And so there is another side. So because I know a lot of times, or we even get calls from families who feel like they have to do a conservatorship, and it's just kind of thrown around as this has to be done, or you're not going to be able to get this service or this treatment. And it's it's a really big deal, a conservatorship, and it really can be useful in certain situations, but it really also can be pretty, it strips people's rights. And so we get the calls when things are more extreme, like someone's parent has the right to consent to their medical treatment, yet the parent doesn't want to consent to this person being able to access birth control. And so, or, and that's, or if they, you know, the person may want to move out of their home and because they're conserved, their conservator doesn't want them to move out of the home. So it's really, it's not something to be entered in too lightly, and also considering what the patient, the individual wants, even if they are conserved, if they're able to communicate that. And I just wanted to briefly touch on, I thought you brought up a really good point about if someone doesn't have the capacity to consent to a treatment, how can they have the capacity to designate someone else? And there's no really clear answers, but just kind of in our experience in communicating with people with developmental disabilities, like she said, you know, capacity is kind of, there could be certain areas where the person might be able to understand and communicate what it is they want, and there could be complex areas that they don't, you know, so it's not fixed. But a lot of times there are people in someone's lives who know them really well, who are able to really understand what that person is communicating in a way that we might not from meeting with a person for a half hour or 15 minutes. But if they're able to have that support person kind of acting as a bridge, and again, there's a lot of common sense and judgment, that can just be really helpful, because someone can communicate. Just communication styles can be so unique with individuals who have developmental disabilities, and it's the people who are with them the most who are really going to sometimes be able to help bridge that gap. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
The UC Davis Mind Institute was created in 1998 with a promise to find cures for neurodevelopmental disorders. Every day, our physicians and researchers come closer to fulfilling that promise. Their groundbreaking research on autism, Fragile X syndrome, chromosome 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, ADHD, and other brain disorders are helping children achieve their fullest potential. Please visit our website to find out more about current studies, upcoming events, and how you can help make a difference.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.